Live every weekday at noon and then as a podcast, this is MoneyWeb at midday. I'm your host, Jimmy Moyaha, standing in for Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes of express news on the latest developments in South Africa and around the world, including interviews with business and political leaders, prominent newsmakers and top commentators. Coming up on today's show, we take a look at what could possibly be driving the delays in the appointment of the new cabinet. We also have a conversation with Dr. Abba Omar around the possible replacement for a particular cabinet portfolio, that is the Ministry of International Relations and Cooperations. Then we have a conversation around the latest developments in the House of the IEC. The IEC Commissioner, Dr. Nomsa Masuku, has been arrested and subsequently granted bail on corruption charges stemming from her tenure at Standard Bank. Then we have a conversation with the National Consumer Commission around the compliance inspections campaign they're embarking on to remove expired goods from shelves. And we finally wrap up the show with a look at the Nguni project that the Department of Agriculture, Rural Development and Environment in Gauteng are currently pursuing.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
So the Democratic Alliance and the ANC and all the other political parties involved in the Government of National Unity are awaiting, as we all are as South Africans, the announcement from the President on who his new cabinet will be for the 7th administration. Now, obviously, there's been speculation and conjecture around why the delay and why this is taking so long to get to. I'm joined on the line by Sandile Swana, political analyst, to take a look at what's unfolding and what could possibly be driving this. Sandile, good day. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, much of the speculation has been around the deputy president's position, with a lot of rumors circulating that the Democratic Alliance would be demanding being given that position as part of the new Government of National Unity. Would the Democratic Alliance be justified in these demands if they're true?
Not necessarily justified, but I suppose you could say if the circumstances present such an opportunity, you'd be foolish not to take it. So from the reading of the game of the Democratic Alliance, the ANC has lost power, its electoral support has gone down, its performance track record is dismal, and mismanagement, even by Ramaphosa himself, is rife. So there's an opportunity to say to Ramaphosa, we can rescue you, rescue the presidency itself. So that is where that, to my mind, is coming from. No, not because it's mandated by any, it's justifiable in any way, but it's an opportunity that if you are opportunistic enough, you might want to take a swipe at to get to it.
Speaking of other opportunities, Sandile, when we look at the other portfolios, which other portfolios would you see the Democratic Alliance potentially wanting to be tasked with? We know that the likes of the Patriotic Alliance have made it clear which portfolios they're interested in. Which portfolios do you think the DA would be gunning for? And which portfolios do you think the ANC are going to say these are non-negotiables?
Portfolios that the DA is going to target are the portfolios where massive privatization is going to be possible. The energy portfolio, energy and minerals, that type of portfolio, with the aim of dismantling and privatizing as a generation more especially. The ports, some of the aspects of the ports and the aspects of the transportation networks of South Africa, including rail, opportunities for privatization. So the DA will be interested in that. Finance, they're very interested in for various reasons. So those portfolios, largely that are in the economic cluster, agriculture would potentially be, agriculture and tourism would probably be those. That is where their focus is, and the police. The DA wants to control security in South Africa. So that would be what the DA would be looking for. Those portfolios are the unions, whether those unions are within COSATU or outside of COSATU, are the same portfolios that they're interested in. Because when you look at history, for instance, since Eskom was privatized, 51,000 people have been retrenched by Eskom. As it says, it is improving profit, but that profit has been at the expense of workers. And the same goes to all these privatized companies, ISCOR and what have you. And you've lost the programs of artisanship, you've lost the employment and the jobs. So there's going to be contestation there. As to which portfolios the ANC would certainly want, where the social grants are being administered, the social development department, they would be there. They've made a mess of education, I don't know, especially education at the lower levels and including FET colleges. I don't know if they want to keep that, but they've made a mess of it. So I think I'll stop there.
Sandile, when we look at the developments within the Government of National Unity, there was an announcement by the African National Congress around the fact that they've effectively not necessarily directly closed off applications, but anyone that would want to be part of the Government of National Unity from this point forward would need to be subjected to the infamous Clause 24 that we've been reading about all over social media. Does this now mean that the parties that didn't get in before a certain date are now going to be subject to this new structure on how parties are admitted? And does that then pose a new threat to the Government of National Unity should someone like the MK Party or the EFF wish to join?
Yes. By the way, I looked at Clause 24 again this morning. Clause 24 has changed on the ANC website. It no longer lists the parties as ANC, IFP, and DA. It says it's just as existing party. As to whether those parties will make a decision by simple majority, in other words, if there are 10 parties, if six vote in favor of you, then you are in. Or it will be a percentage based on the votes in the National Assembly. It's not clear. So as you are aware, that document has got those types of loopholes, but it has been changed in any event. Nevertheless, clearly then, anybody who wants to be admitted there, let's assume, will be admitted by simple majority of the number of parties that constitute the GNU. Yes, there is that vetting, which then challenges the very concept of a government of national unity if it becomes an exclusive club.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how that unfolds. Thanks so much for those insights, Sandile Soana, who is a political analyst, sharing his thoughts on the delays around the new cabinet.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
While the position of deputy president is still up in the air, the entire cabinet effectively has to still be constituted by the president, and we are awaiting the announcements of certain key positions. One of those key positions would be the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation. We know that the current minister, Naledi Pandor, is set to step down and not return to politics, but of course the president at his purview can appoint two non-members of parliament into any capacity when he does put together this cabinet. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Abba Omar, who is a director of operations at the Mapungubwe Institute, to take a look at this particular portfolio and why this is such an interesting portfolio to look at. Dr. Omar, good day. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with the importance of the role of the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation on the world stage.
I think it's really important. For me, you know, there are two very senior cabinet positions. One is obviously Minister of Finance, and I think the other one is the Foreign Affairs Minister. The Foreign Affairs Minister needs to be able to represent us at so many different levels. It needs someone who's able to master the art of thinking at the level of bilateral relations, regional, as in, you know, Africa-wide relations, or EU relations, or America's relations, or Asia relations, and then across the different issues, so like human rights and climate change and trade, etc. So whilst you may have specializations within cabinet, DERCO becomes a lead department in many of these things. So even if you look at the climate change negotiations, the Ambassador Nosipho Diseko was one of our leaders of the delegation that went into COP, supported obviously by the line departments and other specialists. So the Minister of Foreign Affairs then has to be, as I've described in my opinion piece, a intellectual and political heavyweight. So intellectually able to grasp all the details, capture the brief very quickly, understand the implications of that, But politically also, you know, at cabinet, you know, there's obviously a jostling around for what gets prioritized, even on the agenda of cabinet, etc. But at the same time, you need to be able to deal with the political parties. So in this case, you know, with the ANC having been the ruling party for the past 30 years, the foreign affairs minister had to really juggle the relationship between the ANC International Relations Committee, the presidency, the department's needs, and obviously parliament.
Dr. Omar, under the new government of national unity, where we're going to definitely see, and we've already seen, opposing foreign policies within the political parties themselves, how do you then unite under a single policy that the country then stands for? Because that's effectively what we're seeking to do here, is whatever government of national unity we have in place, whatever foreign affairs minister or minister of international relations and cooperations we put in place, has to then speak for the foreign policy of South Africa, not the foreign policy of any individual party. How do you then unite on policy?
So, it's true. It's foreign policy for South Africa, but it's also a party or parties bring their own kind of DNA to the table. So let's say if you still had a nationalist party in power, they would have been still going, you know, prioritizing relations with Washington and London and so forth. Whereas I think the kind of history that the ANC brought into the government it created from 1994 was one of stronger ties with Africa, stronger ties with the global South, stronger international solidarity, etc., etc. So that's what eventually was led up to, for example, the ICJ action on Gaza. So it wasn't a surprise, you know, that the South African government took that position. So you handle that vis-a-vis what's in the national interest of the country. And I think that's where we need to do a fair amount of work still. So under Madiba's leadership, it became quite clear, you know, that all our relations would be based on our commitment to human rights around the world, etc. Under Mbeki's leadership, there was obviously an emphasis on making sure the African agenda. I was a serving ambassador for about 10 years, and, you know, we were told to prioritize the Africa agenda and obviously South Africa's interest. So, you know, there's different presidencies, different foreign ministers bring different kind of emphases. So I think one of the things that would need to happen pretty soon is for the government of national unity to quickly kind of agree on the kind of foreign policy priorities. Durko had produced a national interest document a couple of years ago. I think it needs to go back to that. I think society needs to engage with it more, so that we know what we're committing to, and also having a say in deciding what should be South Africa's interest as far as our foreign policy is concerned.
Dr. Omar, when we look at the world stage, there's war happening in the Middle East, there's the BRICS bloc that's come up, there's de-dollarization happening from the likes of Saudi Arabia. What then becomes South Africa's interest?
Well, it's a couple of things, and this will always be the creative sort of process. So, you know, we all our policy, economic, foreign policy, etc., should be to make sure that it's in the interest of the South African citizenry. So I think that should be our starting point. Now, coming out of that, you know, we can say, look, it's in our interest to make sure that democracy, constitutional arrangements, human rights, etc., prevail. And that's the position we then take on these different conflicts. And then where conflicts break out, we will say that we should try and make sure that they are peacefully resolved. So I think, you know, for example, if you take the Ukraine-Russia thing, I think, you know, sometimes our own government doesn't do its policies big favors. It's not committing to a pro-Russia position or even a pro-Ukraine position, but our president has been clear, calling for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. So that's immediately seen as saying, oh, well, you guys are in favor of Russia, where a NATO position is to bomb Russia back to wherever it came from. Now, we take a position that we want to have this thing peacefully resolved. That's our position. NATO, EU, and all their allies take a position, especially the US, take the position that we're going to arm Ukraine to the teeth and they must fight back and that kind of thing. It doesn't allow the possibility even of a peaceful resolution. And that's what South Africa aims for. It targets arriving at a peaceful resolution through courts, like it did through the for the Gaza issue, through negotiations that it's hoping would occur between Russia and Ukraine and other parties that are involved, etc. It's quite a creative thing to be doing. As a small country in a big world, where we quite often are expected to punch above our weight, we can do that by making sure that we're nimble in the way we do it.
We'll leave it at that. Dr. Abba Omar, Director of Operations at the Mapungubwe Institute, on the importance of the next Minister of International Relations and Cooperation.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Last week, we got confirmation that the IEC commissioner, Dr. Nomsa Masuku, was arrested and granted bail subsequently. She was arrested for corruption charges that relate to her employment while she was employed at Standard Bank. I'm joined on the line by Advocate Paul Hoffman, who is a director at Accountability Now, to take a look at this. And good day, Advocate Hoffman. Thanks for the time. These charges are more than 10 years old. Why are they being brought up now?
Well, that's a question you've got to ask the National Prosecuting Authority, because they told the Sunday Times yesterday that this is what they do, prosecute tall poppies that stick out. I'm afraid that it has something to do with the fact that the hegemony of the ANC has ended, and that the investigators and prosecutors on the case have suddenly grown the necessary fortitude to actually get on with the job. But it could be that the details of the corruption, which basically was diverting money intended for deserving bursary recipients into the pockets of both Ms. Masuku and also her friends and family, that may have taken some time to work out. I do hope that the Standard Bank has either got its money back or that it is making plans to get its money back. But at this stage, the big issue is, besides the criminal case, where proof beyond a reasonable doubt has to be adduced by the prosecution, the big issue is, what is the IEC going to do about it? And all that I've seen in the media so far is that the IEC says that it's monitoring the case. Well, that's just not good enough. The commissioners of the IEC are meant to be as pure as the driven snow. They are enjoined by the Constitution to act without fear, favor, or prejudice, and to behave independently at all times. Now, how you could do that while you've got charges of corruption hanging over you is very difficult to imagine. So I would think that the next step is for the IEC to suspend its commissioner. She has a checkered career, you know. She was one of the panel that looked into the reform of the electoral system while she was also at the same time an IEC commissioner. And by the time the work was done, she realized that she was in a conflict of interest situation. So she did not side with the majority or with the minority of that panel that gave us this latest three-paper election, which did not see a single independent candidate getting elected to Parliament or to a provincial council. So that's the background. And really, your interview at this stage should be with the chair of the IEC. Excuse me, when are you putting this lady on precautionary suspension, given the fact that she is facing charges that impact upon the probity and integrity of your commission?
Advocate Hoffman, according to the reports, the commissioner has been employed by, or she began her employment with the IEC back in 1998. She took a brief period of time away from the IEC and then has sort of returned as commissioner in 2018. So she's got an extensive career spanning involvements within various departments, I suppose, within the IEC. At this point, how then do we determine how deep this goes from an integrity point of view? Granted, it doesn't relate to her current employment, yes, and relates to employment at another organization, but should action from an IEC perspective not have been taken sooner?
Well, I don't think that the IEC knew what was going on at the Standard Bank, in fairness to the IEC. They certainly did know that she saw fit to be on that panel that advised Parliament in relation to the reform of the electoral system. And she seems to have realized rather late in the day that she couldn't go with the majority or the minority, so she simply abstained, which is a complete waste of time and money. And if she'd applied her mind to it in the first place, she would not have participated in that panel because of the clear conflict of interest between the duty of an IEC commissioner to act without fear, favour or prejudice and to be independent, and the task that was given to that committee that was looking into the electoral system. There's been trouble around the independence of the electoral commission from day one. All too often it has been used as the site of cadre deployment by the ANC and its fellow travellers, the Communist Party and COSATU. And it has not acquitted itself as, well, Jacob Zuma and I are on the same page for a change. It's not acquitted itself as well as it might have over the years. We know that the ANC has very unorthodox and probably illegal fundraising methods, which none of the other parties engage in. And the IEC, which has the basic task of ensuring free and fair elections, always certifies the elections as fair when only one party is dipping its claws into the public purse in order to fund its election campaign. That is not the stuff of which a fair election is made, but that perhaps is a little bit beyond the problems that Ms. Masuku is facing at the moment. She is going to have to pay back the money, and she's going to have to face the criminal consequences of such charges as the prosecution service is able to prove against her.
Well, the case does return to court on the 4th of September. Until then, I suppose we do have to wait until the IEC does take any form of additional measures against the current commissioner. We'll leave it at that. Thanks so much, Advocate Paul Hoffman of Accountability Now.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The National Consumer Commission is concerned about the amount of expired goods that are currently on people's shelves and on store shelves. And to that extent, they've launched a compliance campaign. I'm joined on the line by Prudence Moyelwa, who is the head of compliance and investigations at the NCC. To take a look at this, good day, Prudence. Thanks so much for taking the time. When did this come to your attention, and what's so concerning about the expired goods?
Thank you for having us. We've been doing spot checks, I think starting from the World Consumer Rights Week, which was around the 15th of March in Bloemfontein, when we actually picked out that there actually is a problem. But we've also been following just the public discourse where consumers have been complaining about expired goods, and also various incidents that have happened across the country where, you know, the quality of food was brought into question.
Prudence, is this isolated to a particular region, particular retailers, or is it larger retailers, smaller retailers? I noted that the compliance campaign is centered around Limpopo at the moment, and I wonder, is that a particular reason for that?
No, we started with Limpopo, but we aim to do the compliance inspections across the country. And I think it is meant to, and the reason why we're also not going to announce which districts we will be conducting, we hope that will also encourage suppliers to, on their own, stop selling expired goods or goods that are not safe for consumers or goods that have reach their best before dates. The whole campaign comes from the fact that we want consumers to have confidence in things that are sold in the market. And also, it doesn't just affect small suppliers. Yes, we are conducting inspections of small retailers, but we also have been dealing with major retailers who have had product failures in the market as well. If you've been following the work of the commission, you will know that we have just completed the assessment of the peanut butter based on the levels of high aflatoxins. And we've had various recalls by major suppliers of canned foods and so on in the past. So we do not want the misnomer of this to come across as the commission only targeting small retailers. But we want to go as deep as possible to make sure that we cover small retailers as well as major suppliers in the towns, as well as the small in the villages as well, where we can also go to the spaza shops as well.
Prudence, in this campaign that you're embarking on, is it just merely looking at the dates on tinned products or the expiry dates on whatever products it is, or is there actual testing involved with regards to sampling of the products beyond just what the expiry date says?
Yeah, we have a multidisciplinary team right now. It's not only the commission. So when we go to your to a particular district, for example, we work with the environmental health practitioners, we work with the police and other stakeholders as well to make sure that we our approach is you know, from all angles. And what then happens is that the health inspectors would take things for testing, and in certain instances, we will work with them on the issues of testing to make sure that indeed we have, you know, on a balance of probabilities, things that have enough evidence for us if we decide to prosecute. But also with regard to the goods as well, there are goods that you can visibly just with the naked eye see that, for example, the wet piece of chicken that the inspectors found, I think it was in Lebowa Khomo, if I'm not mistaken, where the packaging was destroyed, was broken or had torn, and the chicken was visibly rotten, for lack of a better word. So it's that kind of approach where market monitoring really works, where you're not depending on the pictures that come from consumers. Inspectors themselves would have first-hand experience of the type of food that is being sold.
Prudence, you mentioned the legal side of it, whether you continue to pursue legal action and otherwise. How do consumers, number one, report anything that they need to report to you? And number two, what obligations do sellers have that they need to be aware of that could lead to them being prosecuted if they breach those obligations?
Yeah, it's very important to emphasize this. In terms of the Health Act, that is enforced by the environmental health practitioners and the police, who are part of the stakeholder group that we go with. People who sell food need to have a certificate of compliance, which means they need to prove that before a certificate of compliance is issued, what would happen is that that the environment will be checked. There's a certain level of compliance that is required before anybody can sell food and foodstuffs. That's the first one. The purpose of the Consumer Protection Act, consumers are entitled to good quality goods, number one. Number two, goods that are safe. Two particular sections, Section 55 of the Consumer Protection Act, as well as Section 60 that talks to the recalls and investigations that can be done by the commission where unsafe goods are being sold. So in that regard, we work with stakeholders like your Department of Health, as well as environmental health practitioners and the police, in order to get the evidence so that we can use to prosecute. And as you may know, we prosecuted the National Consumer Tribunal.
Thank you so much for those insights, Prudence. Prudence Moilwa, Head of Compliance and Investigations at the NCC, on their latest campaign.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So the Gauteng Department of Agriculture, Rural Development and Environment has embarked on a new project to increase the amount of Nguni cattle that we have in South Africa. And I'm joined on the line by the project manager at the Gauteng IDC Nguni Cattle Development Project. That's Maliviwe Mbaipeli. To take a look at this particular initiative and why it's here. Maliviwe, thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us more about the project.
Thank you so much for having us, Jimmy. The Gauteng IDC Nguni Cattle Development Project started back in 2011 when the Gauteng Department of Agriculture, Rural Development and Environment was partnered with IDC, which is Industrial Development Corporation, as well as University of Pretoria. Then the project was launched on the 7th of May 2015 by the then MEC for Economic Development, Environment and Agriculture and Rural Development, Telebohang Maile. So what the project entails, it entails loaning qualifying livestock farmers, 30 pregnant female cattle, as well as one stud muni bull as a conditional loan so that the farmers can be able to farm for a period of 5 years. And after 5 years, they return those cattle in the same number and quality so that they can be taken to the next beneficiary. So what we have done since the project was launched in 2015, we have recruited about 14 farmers across the Gauteng province, and four of them have already fully repaid, and four others have started with their repayment plans. And this year, what we have actually received, we have received intent from five other farmers that says they want to start with their repayment plans. So that's about it. Now, the criteria for participation in this project, one needs to be black as defined by the BBBEE Act of 2003. And also they need to have a farm that is located within the boundaries of Gauteng. And that farm has to be about 500 hectares or more so that it can accommodate all the animals that we have within that 5 year period. And also the farm, at least it has to have some form of infrastructure so that when we send our officials to come and assist on a monthly basis, they have to make sure that they are able to do their job without any interruption. Then the other criteria that we look into, if a farmer has animals already in their farms, we have to ensure that those animals are free of any diseases. That is why at the application period, we always require the TB and CA certificates so that we ensure that that herd is free of those diseases. There has to be also make sure that the farmer has got some, what do you call, fences, so that our animals cannot be subjected to some form of stock theft and stuff.
Malivu, let's looking at that criteria. I mean, obviously wanting to improve the amount of black-owned projects and black farmers that we have in South Africa is one side of the initiative. But having a requirement that there needs to be 500 hectares of land available to that farmer to be able to farm, does that not make it a bit exclusionary to the smaller scale farmers? Because not many farmers have that kind of land in their name.
Yes, it's a question that we are always subjected to whenever we try to engage to our farmers. But I want to put it this way, Jimmy. You know, when this decision of 500 hectares was made, it was made on the basis of two factors. One was the issue of the economy of scale, plus the conservation of our natural resources. That is the availability of grazing or capacity. So when that decision was made, you know, we had considered an estimated carrying capacity of about 8.5 hectares per large stock unit, which then those calculations led us to this 500 hectares. So we're trying to balance two things here in terms of the project objectives. We're trying to say we want to make sure that our farmers are able to produce these cattle in large quantities, but at the same time, that should not be at the expense of the environment, which is one of our secondary objectives.
Interesting on the size of the farms. I mean, that, again, quite a steep requirement for farmers from that perspective. Malivio, I want to look at the, why specifically Nguni cattle?
You remember, these are the farmers that are classified as being black, which means they are historical disadvantage. And some of them, you'll find that they are beginners into the space. So we had to choose a breed that we know that it is hardy. In other words, it can adapt to so many, you know, the environments that we have here in Gauteng. For example, the Nguni breed, you'll find that it's highly fertile with long productive life. It is resistant to ticks, and also it is tolerant to tick-borne diseases. It can also be used for crossbreeding, and also its crosses, you find that they do perform well under feedlot conditions. So what we had said, given the nature of the farmers that we are recruiting, we wanted to bring a breed that they can be able to manage and farm with. You'll find that if you were to consider an exotic breed, those breeds, you'll find that they are high in terms of the maintenance and stuff. This one, it was chosen on that basis.
Well, all the best with the project. We wish it much success. I'm sure it's contributing towards our agricultural landscape in a big way. Maliviwe Mpaipeli joining me to reflect on the latest project by the Gauteng IDC to improve the amount of Nguni cattle we have.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
That's been the show, folks. If you've missed it, catch it every day, live weekdays, and then available as a podcast. Thanks for listening and goodbye. We'll be right back.